Eric Sinrod of Duane Morris in the San Francisco office.
And this is Jonathan Armstrong live from London.
Yes, and we're back at you talking to you with respect to our Tech Law 10. And this week's subject is cloud computing. Jonathan, is cloud computing really all that new?
I'm not sure it is, actually, Eric. I think certainly as far as the legal issues are concerned, I think they're quite similar to some of the legal issues that we've come across before in software as a service models, for example. I think sometimes that some of the vendors want us to believe it's new, and I can remember an example of a vendor that tried to renegotiate a contract to reduce the service level standards, but not the price, saying that because it was in the cloud, the pricing model was different. So I think some people are pretending that things are new just to reduce their contractual commitments. But from a legal point of view, I'm not sure that much has changed.
Is this really just all marketing buzz?
I think some of it is. I think some of the concepts are slightly different. And I think that things like shared services is an extension of what we've had before with a software as a service model. But as I say, I think legally, the same issues probably crop up as they have done for the last 10 years or so.
So you're talking about legally, and obviously we're lawyers, so let's talk about that. What can you tell us with respect to data protection and data privacy legislation that's affecting the cloud and any potential new laws that are dealing with cloud computing?
Well, I think it's important to remember that data protection and data privacy law will still bite. And I think we've had reminders of that from some of the regulators. One of the German regulators, for example, is saying that he starts from the assumption that cloud computing is unlawful. And his rationale for that is that, generally speaking, European privacy law obliges a user of cloud services or any form of shared services to say where the servers are and where the data is going to be held. And with public cloud, that's a difficult thing to pull off, because quite often the whole notion of cloud is that you move the server locations about to cope with spare capacity. I think some of the regulators are trying to look at this specifically. The UK Information Commissioner's Office recently published a code of practice which included guidance on cloud computing and a really helpful checklist for vendors and for purchasers of cloud services so that they could try and square off some of the legislative risk. I know that Canada's done something broadly similar. There's a proposal for new legislation, which Microsoft, I think, is sponsoring over there in the US. I think that there's very little new law, but some of the regulators are interpreting old law a bit better. But I think maybe one of the things that will impact cloud and will govern it more and more as we go forward will be service level agreements. Do you agree with that, Eric?
I really do, Jonathan. I'm glad you brought that up, because you know what we're dealing with, you know, on the internet and in the cloud are, you know, mass quantities of information and content. And you know, questions arise as to who's responsible for the content, especially when there's potential liability. And service level agreements can address that, place responsibility where it truly belongs, you know, govern the relationships specifically in terms of who has particular obligations in terms of maintaining information and making sure information is protected in certain contexts. So the service level agreements are critically important, and there isn't necessarily a one-size-fits-all. They need to be tailored specifically to given context and particular relationships, and it's not sufficient for, you know, parties entering into an agreement simply to do a cut and paste. I think that's good enough. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, one of the good things that I've seen in the past few months has been the ENISA report in Europe. And I think it's ENISA's one of these strange Brussels-based organizations that tries to coordinate things across Europe. And I think it makes some good points, saying, for example, that service-level agreements are important, but the cloud isn't necessarily a bad thing, particularly for smaller sized businesses, putting data into the cloud, so long as they do it right, might actually mean that they're more secure and that their response rates are better because they can share services with other organizations that may have more resource than them. I guess one of the, from my point of view, I mean, coming from a European background where we don't have too much issues around e-discovery and pre-action discovery in court cases and things like that, that would be the thing that frightens me from a European perspective, because over there in the US, you're much more driven on things like discovery and touching documents wherever they reside. Is that likely to cause issues in the cloud?
Incredibly true, yes. E-discovery is the rage in litigation right now. Essentially, when parties need discovery, it's all about E, the electronic data. And there are new rules in place in terms of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and in terms of the procedures that have been amended in various states. And the rules are fairly strict. And e-discovery can be onerous and burdensome and intrusive, but extremely important. And, you know, questions will certainly come up. There's no doubt in my mind that e-discovery will be sought with respect to information maintained in the cloud. Questions will arise in terms of who is supposed to produce that information. If a party A is in a given lawsuit and needs to respond to discovery, but some of their data is off with a vendor in the cloud, is it sufficient for the discovery request to go to party A, or do subpoenas need to be issued to the vendor? If the subpoenas need to go to the vendor, they're then a third party in the case. Are their responsibilities a little less strict than would be a direct party in the case? Would their costs incurred in terms of providing the information potentially be recoverable from the other side? These are very important issues, and some of the judges are coming down hard on e-discovery abuse. There was a recent decision from a federal magistrate in Baltimore imposing a potential prison sentence in addition to a default judgment with respect to e-discovery noncompliance. So that's a very large issue, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Confirms my worst fears about the U.S. system then, I guess. I know we said we'd stick to 10 minutes, so I could talk about this forever, but should we wrap it up now? Because I know we said we'd stick to 10. I think we're always keen, aren't we, Eric, to have people suggest topics for future podcasts and give us feedback, good or bad, on the type of things that we're talking about. Obviously, you can revisit our podcast on social networking if you like. Eric, do you want to give your email address?
Yes, please. So if you have any comments or questions, as Jonathan suggested, my email address is ejsinrod, S-I-N-R-O-D, at duanemorris.com, D-U-A-N-E, morris.com. And Jonathan, yours is?
jparmstrong at duanemorris.com. Armstrong spelled exactly the same way as my Uncle Lance.
and Neil Armstrong, who landed on the moon. Okay, thank you for joining us this week, and we'll be back to you soon. Goodbye.
Take care.